Mr. Speaker. One is that his middle name is Kenneth. and the other is that two of his students, when he taught, were Prince Charles and Colin Powell.
You can odd bag.
You can take your pick. He is a graduate of the Naval Academy and also has degrees from Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. And he served for 20 years in the Navy, including five tours in destroyers, and the last of those in command. In Vietnam, he skippered a swift boat and later had a collection of swift boats. This is a civilian formulation that I undertook over 150 patrols and a variety of combat missions, including combat assault and gunfire support and special or clandestine operations. He also spent 2 years in the Royal Navy, much of it in a ship's company, in a frigate, and later in the staff of the Royal Britannia Naval College at Dartmouth. And that's where Prince Charles discovered him.
Briefly.
Then he became professor at the National War College and directed courses in military strategy and political strategy, I believe. He served as a special assistant of the Secretary of Defense and there had considerable to do with the defense budget and other tasks. Well, there's much else one could say about his career. He moved from there to a period when he taught at various institutions, and then combined teaching with the creation of a business of his own that involved activities in Asia. So in all respects, therefore, he has had a fascinating career and lots of stories and lots to think about for all of us. So we're delighted that you're here.
Ken, thank you very much. I think I'll stand so everybody can hear me. I'd like to meet that guy that you just introduced, by the way. The theme or the subtext of my sermon today is humility. I'm very grateful to the Millett Center and particularly to Phil Williams, who's a Fletcher colleague and fellow graduate, and his lovely wife, who I just met, for extending the invitation. And I hope for another one of our Fletcher friends who's coming down the road quickly, who will also be here, but it's a great honor and a great privilege. Because the Millett Center is so much focused on the presidency, I thought I might begin my lecture in humility with a story that's appropriate about William Howard Taft. Now, you may recall about President Taft, who was president about 90-odd years ago. The most obvious thing was his weight. He weighed some 320 pounds. In fact, he was so fat he couldn't even tee up a golf ball playing his favorite game. He also had a running rivalry with Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes. And one day it fell to Mr. Holmes, as it did to Mr. Thompson, to introduce Mr. Taft, which Oliver Wendell Holmes did by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, I give you our pregnant president." With that, the president rose and composed himself slowly, as somebody of that weight and size would, ambled slowly to the podium and turned to the audience and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to know that Mrs. Taft and I are aware of my condition. We've decided that if it turns out to be a boy, we'll name it after me. If it turns out to be a girl, we'll name it after Mrs. Taft. But if, as we both suspect, it's nothing more than a bad case of gas, we'll call it Oliver Wendell Holmes." I say that to preface my remarks because I think they will be very provocative and I think they will be somewhat daunting. And they come based on this book called Unfinished Business, which was published in June with a foreword by John McCain, who, as you all know, is a senator from Arizona and also a very, very good friend. Let me be relatively brief and succinct so you have a lot of time for questioning. I also like to use McCain's favorite introduction of himself, saying that when he addresses an audience, he refers to himself as, here's the latest dope from Washington. So consider me in that context, too. These are really quite serious times. What was profoundly different about September 11th was that 19 men, armed only with box cutters and loyal to a cause and an ideology, not a country, did more damage in a short space of time than all the Soviet nuclear weapons during the Cold War did in 40 years, killing over 3,000 people and doing untoward damage to American psyche, to American attitudes, and to our economy. Now, that act did not happen by accident. It happened because of what I refer to as legacies and pieces of unfinished business. And obviously, every era has legacies and unfinished business. From World War I, the legacies and unfinished business led to fascism in Japan and Germany and World War II. World War II led to the Cold War and the Gulf War. And from the Gulf War, we have, in my judgment, five pieces of unfinished business that now we have to deal with if we are ever to be safe and secure. And my concern is that despite this so-called war on terrorism, the risks and dangers that we face may be as profound as any as we have seen since the Civil War, which was probably the most destructive and dangerous period in our history, and I shall tell you why. The first piece of unfinished business refers to the targets of these extremists, and I will refer to them as extremists rather than terrorists, and I will explain that in a moment. They are citing themselves on the very openness, the accessibility, and the freedom of our system, and that by attacking our system, Nihal, welcome, and I apologize for deserting you this morning. This is another Fletcher graduate, Nihal Gudawardhan. Thank you. They are focusing on the openness of our society and its accessibility. And the more problems that they can create, the more ways we have to secure ourselves, which is an inherent assault on our freedom. The more that we want to be safe, the more safeguards and the less our freedom is going to be, so that the basis of the attack really gets to the openness of our political society. The second piece of unfinished business is that no matter what we say and do, the United States in any Western society is fundamentally vulnerable. There is no way that we can protect all of the people all the time, or even some of the people some of the time. And if you don't believe me, just recall a couple of weeks ago when the snipers were running havoc throughout this part of the country and how petrified we were. So that the very openness and the vulnerability of our infrastructure, our society, our telecommunications, banking system, is something that can be manipulated virtually at will. Thirdly, whether we like it or not, as Senators Hart and Rudman concluded in a report they issued a year and a half ago on national strategy, we are simply not organized to protect ourselves, that the organization of the U.S. government is dysfunctional. And the reason it's dysfunctional is that it's still organized for the Cold War, where we had a monolithic adversary in the form of the Soviet Union. Now the adversaries are fundamentally different. The fourth piece of unfinished business is that we have to deal with extremism that comes from what Zbigniew Brzezinski, former national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, called the crescent of crisis that extends from the Middle East, the Arab-Israeli conflict, all the way through the Persian Gulf, through Iran, Iraq, to India, Pakistan, and as far east as the Bay of Bengal, Indonesia, where approximately 1.3 or 1.4 billion Muslims live. Now it is from this crescent of crisis that extremism is bred, and it's bred for a variety of complicated and different reasons. The Arab-Israeli conflict is certainly part of it. Repressive regimes in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and remember some 16 or 17 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, form of government alienates people. In Pakistan, tens of thousands of kids don't have the resources, the money, for food, shelter, and education, and clothing. So they're sent to these horrible madrasas, which are these extreme forms of virulent anti-Westernism, anti-Americanism that are taught under the rubric of the Quran and Islam. So from all of that, from poverty, from ideology, from jealousy, comes this sort of phenomenon of Osama bin Laden, in which bin Laden and his followers, and it's not just Al-Qaeda, but it is his followers who really want to form some kind of a pan-Islamic fundamentalist regime without borders that covers this whole crescent of crisis, that is armed with Pakistan's nuclear weapons and Saudi money. And they're going to use force and terror and weapon as weapons and tactics to achieve their end. And it's something that I believe you could ask whether is this Pancho Villa in 1916 and a one-time raid on the United States, or is this a Lenin and 75 years of struggle? And I think it's going to be Lenin and 75 years of struggle, irrespective of whether it's Osama bin Laden or somebody else in charge. And my guess is there'll be a more competent version. The final piece of business, the fifth, is that during the Cold War, we had a series of alliances, a strategy of containment and deterrence that worked. We had NATO, and those of you who can remember your history books, we even had CETO and CENTO and a number of other pacts that helped to surround the Soviet Union. We do not have the equivalent strategy or structure today. We need some form to integrate our new friends in China and Russia, the European Union, and other states if we are ever to be safe and sound in the future. So these are the five pieces of unfinished business that are challenging us. What to do? Let me just give you some food for thought, because it's very easy to identify problems, but it's far more difficult to solve them. First, regarding the domestic side, that is to say, the inherent vulnerability of our society and its infrastructure and the dysfunctionality of our government. In essence, we need to take out some of the politics from government, which is very, very tough to do. But those of you who are following the debate over the Homeland Security Department will realize that September 11th took place 15 months ago. Hart Rudman issued a second report that came out last month under the auspices of the Council on Foreign Relations, which said we are more insecure today than we were on September 10th. So what have we done in all that time? We've debated whether or not to establish this department. We've gotten to a fight over unions. It's been extremely ugly. And by the way, we haven't even bothered to address the critical issues of law enforcement and intelligence, which are the heart of any solution. Welcome to America. So how do you fix that? The first thing I suggest that we need to do is to form in the U.S. Congress a committee on national and domestic defense and security. It would consist of the major leadership, the speaker, the majority leaders, minority leaders, whoever else, and it would interact directly with the National Security Council, that's to say the president, the vice president, the key cabinet members. And they would form and agree on policy. And by doing that on these critical issues that pertain specifically to national security and the defense of the United States, they would be able to cut through a lot of this bureaucratic nonsense, both in the executive branch and in the Congress. Because if we don't, we're not going to get the right answers, and we will be hit again. I'm sorry to guarantee that, but that's going to happen the next time is liable to be worse. So that's the first thing we need to do. Secondly, we need to go back to the National Security Act of 1947, which was amended in 1949 and 1958, that set up the Cold War structure, which were these stovepiped organizations, a Department of Defense that was going to fight the Soviet military, the State Department that was going to take care of diplomacy, Central Intelligence that was going to get all the intelligence that we needed, these separate stovepipes. Well, the problem is that was terrific when you had a threat like the Soviet Union and you could see their divisions and their ships and their airplanes, and you could come up with an order of battle. But what do you do about bin Laden? Doesn't belong to a state, he's got no real homeland, and everything he does cuts across all of these departments. It cuts across law enforcement, it cuts across intelligence, and it cuts across defense, and it cuts across diplomacy. So what we need to do is change that act, and I would be happy to go into greater detail. Generally speaking, what I favor is to follow the British model, where you have an MI6 for foreign intelligence, an MI5 for domestic intelligence, and a Scotland Yard for law enforcement, and to change our intelligence and law enforcement structure so that it really conforms to those models, which means breaking an awful lot of China. And I have to note that if we couldn't pass a Homeland Security Act in 15 months, how much chance do we have to pass a new National Security Act? Well, if we don't, shame on us. And so the next time a September 11th happens, and it will, sadly, we only have ourselves to blame. And regarding the protection of the United States itself, unfortunately, we have it backwards. We're looking to form a cabinet-level position. We're looking at coordinating the federal government. Where it counts are the first responders. It's the firemen. It's the law enforcement people. It's the emergency services, healthcare workers at the local and state levels that are going to be critical, because we have to be able to respond. And the fact of the matter is that firemen and fire hoses in New Jersey are not compatible with fire hoses in New York, different sizes. The interoperability problem is unbelievable. Got 50 different states. And if there's a crisis, as we discovered on September 11th or with the anthrax attacks, it exhausted most of our medical research capabilities. And there were only a handful of letters, only a handful of people. So you're going to have to bring resources from one state to another to bear. Well, they can't talk to each other because they don't have common radios. They don't have a common operating doctrine. They have no means of interoperability. And their stuff doesn't always fit. You've got to fix that. This is not a big deal. But it requires common sense, organization, and money. This is not rocket science. We're not going to the moon. But we've got to cut through all these politics. Now, internationally, I think there are several things we need to do. First, we need to establish a brand new Marshall-like plan, which might cost us $100 billion a year, and it hurts our deficit. Too bad. It's more than just giving away food. True, it's got to deal with poverty in Pakistan, because unless we attack that, we're always going to have these madrasas, we're always going to have this radical Islam that's going to be trying to infect people. So we need to have a more comprehensive version, but it's also got to deal with Saudi Arabia. It's got to deal with Egypt. If we don't make political progress in those countries, there'll always be grounds for extremism. So that's extraordinarily important. The next thing we have to do, which is probably tougher than a National Security Act revision, is to impose a peace in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians. In 1973, Malcolm Toon, who was then our ambassador to Israel, then he became our ambassador in the Soviet Union, made the observation that the only way we're going to have peace in that region is to impose it. Now, the Israelis will go absolutely ballistic. They won't accept any kind of this stuff. What we're going to have to do is really confront them and say, all right, we'll start small. We'll put a small international force, say, in a part of the Gaza, and then work from there. But unless or until we start making progress in the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian issue, the grounds for extremism will never, never go away. And then finally, what we need to do is to begin constructing these new alliances and new measures for dealing with the nature of the world. My recommendation is we start with proliferation of and nuclear weapons. And we have a great opportunity with North Korea, who just told us directly in our face, screw you, we're developing these things no matter what you do. So what I would argue is to start a series of what I would call strategic stability talks with all the nuclear powers, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, Israel, Pakistan, India, and now North Korea, China, and bring them together for the purpose of saying, okay, how do we make sure these weapons are never used, and how do we make sure we begin building them down? And from that starting point, we can then move out the scale to deal with international terror, extremism, and all the other things that have to be done. This is a great and marvelous country. It is the greatest place for opportunity, possibly, that the world has ever seen. I don't want to sound like a politician now. But it certainly has these marvelous benefits and blessings of freedom and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. No other country has it written down. Pursuit of happiness is one of the main objectives. This is all under attack. It's under attack in the most fundamental way. And the issue is more than wake up America. We've got to get serious. It's going to require average people like you and me demanding of their politicians, put all this nonsense behind you and let's reach solutions. Because unless we do that, there are going to be future September 11ths. They could involve weapons of mass destruction. They could involve fundamental disruptions to our society. Think what 50 snipers in 20 cities would do to this country. And if you want to scare yourself, think what smallpox or some other horrible disease could do. That is being thrust upon us. And for us to be able to deal with that without compromising our basic rights and liberties as individual citizens is an unbelievable testing challenge, I believe, equivalent to that of the Civil War. But it's up to us. We can either demand of our elected officials and our appointed officials that they do the job, or we try and find other people. That is probably the biggest piece of unfinished business we have. With that, I would be delighted to answer your questions. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am. Could you identify yourself so I know who I'm talking to?
My name is Uriah.
And you're a student here.
I'm actually a student at PBCC.
Piedmont. Sorry. How would a security act, I actually have two questions. How would a security act based on a British model work in a country that is this large with a population that is this large? And how would people react to the loss of freedom that would come with the consolidation of law enforcement and first responders? That's my first question.
Yep.
Okay.
And you got another one?
Yeah. How do you suggest we impose a peace in the Middle East? Is it really the United States' place to put ourselves in these conflicts? Why should we, the United States, be a bully in other people's nations? What's our right? What right do we have to do that?
Those are great questions, and I appreciate them. First, I was not suggesting the National Security Act was going to be based entirely on the British system, which you know is a parliamentary system. And in fact, the British Prime Minister with a 220-seat majority, as Tony Blair has, is a benign despot. So your point about freedom is a very good one. What I'm saying is that to deal with law enforcement and to preserve our fundamental rights, because it's my view that given a choice between freedom and security, I would err towards freedom. What we are not is not organized properly. It's more than just the FBI sending liaison officers to CIA and CIA sending liaison officers to FBI. The job of the FBI is to catch criminals, okay, not to do domestic intelligence. So my plan would be that you would change that nature. You would create something like Scotland Yard or a new form of FBI. And then you would have domestic intelligence and you would have foreign intelligence with very careful oversight. A lot of that oversight would be done by this new committee in Congress, because I'm very concerned that in protecting our freedoms, we can destroy our freedoms. So I'm very sensitive to your point, and I don't think that this particular model that I'm suggesting is inherently sensitive towards imposing upon our freedoms. It's the people who are going to be in charge regardless. Your point about the Middle East, whether we like it or not, we're the most powerful country in the world. And it is in our interest to have peace and stability. So we're going to have to take the lead. We cannot do it by ourselves. If we don't get the European Union, if we don't get Arab states involved, if we don't get the UN particularly involved, as we learned in this deal with Iraq, it's much more powerful to have 15-0 unanimous vote by the Security Council telling Saddam to do something than us stamping our feet like angry children. And so in this case, we have to take the leadership role. And we're going to have to put some our own forces on the ground and at risk. Now, it could be as the situation is in Bosnia, where there's some 15,000 NATO forces, of which only 2,000 are Americans. But we're going to have to take the lead. We're going to have to do it internationally. And we're going to have to make the case, because the toughest sell is not necessarily going to be to the UN or the EU or any or NATO. It's going to be the Israelis, because they're going to pout and pout. And you can just imagine if Netanyahu becomes the prime minister again, you know, we're going to declare war against the United States, we're going to use nuclear weapons against you, and we're going to say, fine, we're going to take our $3 billion and go home. And we're going to have to get the American Jewish community here on our side, because the question is, what is more important, our country and our future, or any other state in the world? Now, I'm not saying this to be dictatorial, but it is our future that is on the line, and we've got to take this seriously, and it's also in the best interest of the Israelis. But it's going to be tough. If we don't, there are going to be lots of Osama bin Ladens, and your children and your children's children are going to be worrying about the issues and worrying why you and your generation did not take greater action to protect them in the future. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Next question. Who has the next question? Yes. Good, Mr.
Just a minute, sir.
You spoke of independent committees in Congress. How do you propose to take the politics out of independent?
I didn't say independent committees. I said a new committee. And we did it during 50 years of Cold War. I mean, you had Arthur Vandenberg's on the one side and Dick Russell's on the other. The politics stopped at the water's edge. And what we have to do is declare that in terms of national and domestic security, these are really important issues. Now, if it doesn't work, we're stuck. And I'm not suggesting it naturally is going to work. But unless or until something like that does, it's going to take one or two or three or four more September 11ths to make us come to our senses. And so what Congress has got to do is to say, this is too important to be left to politics. It's a big struggle. It may not happen. It may be like my solution for the Middle East. But if we don't try to approach that, I can almost assure you, well, let me put it this way. Does anybody remember what the last two new cabinet positions we established were? Education and energy. Now, does anybody want to tell me that our education and our energy situation is a lot better now when we have the departments than it was when we didn't? And the answer is no. Do you think Homeland Security Department is going to really protect us a lot more? I think the answer is no. Is it necessary? Sure. So unless we can get that realization through in the political process, we're never going to get ahead of the game. Now, you're right to be cynical. You're right to question whether this can be done. But I don't see an alternative. I don't see an alternative. And as individuals and voters, we ought to vote people into Congress who we can trust to do this. I mean, the Congress is enormously responsive to its individual constituents, enormously so. And if there is a public outcry for this, I think it would be very difficult for the Congress to resist. But right now, I don't see any signs of any real improvement. And in fact, I think that the 108th Congress is going to be even more raucous and more difficult and more disreputable than the 107th Congress, even though the Republicans now control both houses and the White House. We'll see.
Next question. Philip.
Carlin, could you discuss the new Homeland Security Agency with its 22 sub-agencies?
Yeah.
Can you discuss that in the from the point of view of the reality of how it might work? It strikes me that it's a six-step child by definition from the beginning.
Yeah.
And that until issues are resolved between CIA and FBI, that no institution we create will be have half a chance at being successful, particularly in as much as terrorism is so transnational in nature today.
You've answered your own question. It's like a self-licking ice cream cone. I mean, I agree with you.
It does look like that.
it's interesting. Let me tell you a little story because it talks about your question about American politics. You will recall that President Bush was fundamentally opposed to a Homeland Security Department. And then all of a sudden he became convinced, gee, we need it. Now, the bright guys in White House, like Karl Rove, said, boy, we can really use this to screw the Democrats because we can take on the unions. And the idea was the president is saying, I need all this flexibility that other presidents have because we have 170,000 people and I got to fire these people and, you know, move them around, I got to do this. Of course he needs to do that. But the White House version of the bill really did a job on the unions so that the Democrats, if they approved it, would get the bill that they wanted. Remember, Joe Lieberman, senator from Connecticut, was the one who was pushing it. But they'd have to bite on this very, very, very tough bullet of really beginning the first step of encroaching, sort of like the NRA and any kind of gun control. You've got to stop it at the water's edge. This is the same sort of thing. So the White House was win-win. If the Congress didn't pass it, Bush could hit him against, use it against him as he did. And if it does, it puts a dent in the union. Now, okay, having said that, it'll take 4 or 5 years. Where are they going to go? Where's their building? Where's their office for openers? What are the rules and regulations? So it's going to take a long time for this thing really to get underway. During that period, though, when you look at Homeland Security, who are the really important people? Well, first of all, there are people in immigration and naturalization. They're the consular officers who give the visas. They're the baggage handlers and checkers. So now you have not just 170,000, but probably 500,000 people. And it may well be that the screener is more important because he or she is the one who's the first line of defense. It didn't happen that way before. Where are you going to get these people from? So you've got a huge problem of recruitment. You've got to bring in all these people, and it's a zero failure situation. If one person fails at the wrong time, it's disastrous. And you haven't addressed yet the issue of the FBI and the CIA law enforcement and also intelligence. On top of that, you've got all the subcommittee chairmen in various budget committees. For example, Don Young of Alaska is subcommittee chairman of the Transportation Department and does not want to lose the Coast Guard because he's going to lose control of their budget authority. So you have all these politics going on the Hill, irrespective of party. So my sense is that this is going to be something of a disaster. It looks like Tom Ridge, a former governor of New Jersey and now the president's director of Homeland Security, will be the department head. And Gordon England, who's currently Secretary of the Navy, will be the deputy. But I think you need to get somebody who is a combination of Vince Lombardi and Attila the Hun to run that department, because you're going to have to break heads and do it. And the first thing that's going to happen is they start doing something and there's going to be a scream and the president's going to get 100 phone calls from Congress saying, mah, 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 mah. And that translates in ways that I don't want to say in this audience. And that's what's going to happen. And as a result, will we be any safer? I don't think so. Could we? And we're still not focusing on first responders. So I'm afraid that's a very pessimistic answer. But the nature of our system is going to make us react in ways that are just not necessarily in the best interest of our country.
Next question, like comment. Is there something underlying your whole approach to this that is different than the Marshall Plan, which you invoke as the ultimate solution to part of it? General Marshall, after the speech at Harvard, then almost immediately set out to find out what the Europeans thought.
Right.
And we didn't move an inch until we knew exactly what the French and the British and the others felt. And it just seems to me that as formulated, you're asking us to do it all. And yet the real task is to have partners in this who are doing as much as we do from the very beginning.
This is rather like Bernard Shaw's marvelous comment that the United States and Britain are divided by a common language. Mm-hmm. And I use shorthand because everybody knows what the Marshall Plan is, whether you do or you don't, everybody remembers it. No, you're absolutely right. But this Marshall Plan would be much more, would be broader and deeper. And obviously, as we began to implement it, we would have to work very, very closely with our allies and friends and integrate this in a political, social, economic way. And so it would vary from state to state. I mean, we're not going to go to Pakistan and say, here's $100 million, spend it. We're going to have to sit down and determine what it needs to be done and how do we have this kind of cooperative basis. That's how it's going to have to evolve. I mean, it's not going to be, here's the plan, let's do it. It's going to take we're going to have to commit ourselves, put the resources up, get our very best people, and then work over the space of a year or two to begin administering this thing. We're talking about, as I said, it was 75 years of struggle against the Bolsheviks. This could be a longer struggle.
Next question. Yes, of course, Mr. Holo, Robert Holo.
Yes. One of your salient points was that we are doing things upside down, that instead of the federal level, it should be done at the local level. It seems to be that's one of the most difficult things, because there is no infrastructure between the states and the counties and the cities and what have you to work out these differences. And plus you have state legislatures and the same turf problems that you have on the federal level multiplied by 50. How can we get around that?
Well, the number of ways. We're looking at putting in place a sort of framework or infrastructure. The first thing I would make sure that we do is we have common radios. Very easy for the federal government to have the same radio to all the various emergency services as a very first step. Second, we can begin, and you're going to have to work through the 50 governors, coming up with a common operating crisis doctrine. Coming up with common parts that are interchangeable. That's not going to happen overnight. And what you're going to have to do is to work through each of the governors and states to make sure that this thing can be worked out. Well, we've done it. I mean, we do it with basic laws. We do it with trade and commerce. I mean, we have complete interoperability. I mean, you pick up a telephone and you call North Carolina. If we can make telephones work, why can't we make the other work? So I appreciate your point. But this is a question of organization, not so much a question of turf. And I think in that regard, given the fact that commerce works extremely well, this could too. But you need to have a focal point, you need to have a champion for it, and you need to pick three or four ways to start. I would go to every police force in the country, and I would make sure that I had at least one officer on each shift cleared for classified material, so that the FBI can say, by the way, you've got this thug in the neighborhood or whatever. Currently, it's a need to know, and you don't have the need to know, and you don't have the clearance. So there are a number of things that can be done that are fairly simple that begin this particular process. But if we don't, I'll give you an example. This Muhammad Atta, as you may or may not know, one of the hijackers, left his car in Portland, Maine, and three gumshoes from the FBI were sent up to Portland to find the car. So they were up there, and the police chief, who had been a police chief before in Philadelphia, this was not kind of a backwoods bumpkin, this was a guy who was very, very skilled, said, can I give you any help? And they said, if you give us any help, we're going to arrest you for interference and conspiracy, stay the hell out of the way. So the feds are stumbling around for 2 weeks, and finally the boys in Washington are saying, hey guys, we need to get this done. They call up the Portland chief of police and say, chief, we need your help, can you help us find the car? Guess how long it took for the Portland police to find the car? 12 minutes. It's that kind of coordination that's lacking, and that doesn't require state capitals or anything else. It requires the basic infrastructure, and we can do it, especially if you believe the nation is at risk. That's the biggest thing that September 11 should have taught us. Those oceans no longer protect us.
Next question. Yes. No, are you? And then you have to.
You have two questions. You can answer either one or both. One on the international area, yeah. Regarding the Marshall Plan approach. Democracy is the anathema of these extremists.
Right.
So it seems to me that a very high priority would be to aggressively promote democratic society. Now, I know that's difficult and easy for me to say we ought to do that, but I think that is really something that ought to be done on a, and I'm interested in your
right.
opinion on that. And the second thing, a question has to do with the concept of our protection begins at the water's edge. And with regard to what, if anything, more we should do in the area of immigration policy, in regard to control of mm-hmm. incoming visitors, and for that matter, figuring out how we can find out where the currently illegal
sure.
visitors are.
Sure.
Those are my questions.
Those are two good questions. Regarding the first, I disagree with your premise. Extremists don't hate democracy. They are indifferent to it. What they dislike is American presence and America's role in certain places, and now they're getting charged up over the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian issue. So I don't think that democracy is the cause, and I don't think that democracy is a solution. In fact, if you take a look around the world, we're the only country that has the kind of democratic system that we do. You can argue that we're the smartest people and we only know that, or other people know something that we don't know. So imposing that is not necessarily the solution. Having said that, there are a number of people in this administration, particularly Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, who believe that going into Iraq, getting rid of Saddam, and imposing democracy will have these salutary effects in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, and the sort of one-stop shopping. And they also argue that democracies don't fight democracies. Well, that's patently not true historically. So I don't believe that democracy is particularly the solution. I think what the solution is a standard of law and justice that is relatively fair and equitable, whether you have a system that's a semi-democracy or not. I think putting in the rule of law is important. And to try and establish a democracy in Saudi Arabia would be a bad joke. That's just not going to happen. So how do you make, short of a revolution, these changes over time? So I think that my view in terms of this Marshall Plan is really focusing more on the rule of law and rights of individuals, irrespective of the political solution, because you can push democracy so far and only so far. Your second question is also a very pertinent one, because it gets to the issue of the conflict between freedom and security. I mean, how much are you going to draw these lines? There is no doubt that we have to be far better in terms of issuing our visas than we have been, and that just requires money. It's going to take time. There's legislation in place, but I agree with you that visas need to be more carefully regulated, and if that chokes off time and place, that's just one of the prices that we have to pay. At the moment, I'm afraid there's no way we're going to deal with the illegal alien problem here, because it's just too large for the time being. So I think what we have to do is basically start from scratch, beginning with visas. And quite frankly, I think that this politically correct policy of not profiling anybody is incredibly wasteful. I mean, why do you want to pick on a 75-year-old white grandmother American to see if she's got stuff in her shoes? I mean, I can almost guarantee you that she is not going to be a fundamentalist Islamic radical going to blow up an airplane. So we have to really deal with our own society to that regard. But we have to move carefully, because we can go too far. And my greatest concern is that just by their threat, the extremists can cause us to do more damage to our way of life by restricting our freedoms. You may have seen the Bill Safire piece yesterday in the New York Times, referring to DARPA, that's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency program, to have this internet that collects, like a vacuum cleaner, information about everybody, so that they know everything about you, from your social security number, shoe size, number of girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever. That's an extreme, but Safire, even though he's a very conservative, fellow, is very concerned about individual liberties. And as I said earlier, I would always err towards freedom, but this is a new conflict. And you know, in times of crisis, when we picked up all the Japanese Americans during World War II, we did worse things during World War I. Our policy towards the Indians during the 1800s was not exactly humanitarian. We've had these bouts of leaving democracy behind. And in some cases, they're understandable. Some cases are even justified. In this case, we've got to be very careful. And that's what bothers me most about this.
You had a question? Yeah.
This is a two-part question, although they're related. The first is, in your description of the crescent.
Yeah.
Clearly, and all of us have recognized that the overriding unity in this whole enterprise seems to be the Islamic experience. So the first question is this in fact a religious war? Secondly, to build on your reflections about our level of preparedness, we are a country that has become preoccupied with the separation of church and state, and within that framework of political correctness, not to introduce religion or religious philosophy
right.
into negotiations. Mm-hmm. I'm beginning to think that the second part is an impairment, and the going back to the first part of my question, to what degree do you believe that this is in fact motivated by a religious conviction? The whole Islamic outreach against the world, and I'm focusing
sure.
also in places like the Sudan,
sure.
Nigeria, other parts of the African enterprise, where in fact Christianity is growing in leaps and bounds,
yep.
as opposed to say in this country, but where the tension, religious tension between Islam and Christianity is virulent.
That's a very prescient perspective and question, because there's a very real tendency for some people to argue that this is a fundamental flaw of Islam, and really Islam is the enemy, and we're just sort of papering over our relationships with the Saudis and other Muslims who are our friends to deal with it. The best analogy, and I don't believe that, but you can make that case. I think that's a mistake. The best analogy I can make, and I know this will be potentially taken offensively, and it's not meant to, but 150 years ago in this country, people thought blacks were secondary, tertiary people, that they just weren't as good as whites. And so our attitude towards blacks was based on this mistaken view. That is could clearly, in my judgment, what could happen with Islam. What happened to my mind is that within Islam, there is a basis for a fundamentalist, extremist view, which is nuts. And it really is nuts. But it's also true in Judaism. I mean, who was the guy that killed Rabin? He was a sort of right-wing, crazy Jewish nut. Thank goodness he was Jewish and not an Arab. Otherwise, we'd have World War III on our hands. And the same thing with Christian fundamentalists and radicals. I mean, you've got people. So what you have, crazy is probably not the right word, but you've got these zealots, and they're part of any religion. And unfortunately, our lack of knowledge of Islam and the fact that it's very easy to make the argument that is this not a clash of religions and is not Islam wrong because you have four wives and women have got to wear these abayas and they don't have any rights and isn't that horrible, makes that case. I think we would be making a huge mistake if we did that. What we need to do is to drive the causes for extremism down to the very minimum amount. We can't have these Osama bin Ladens running around. And so we have to deal with that. We also have to make countries like Saudi Arabia more progressive, which means they've got to take a more progressive view of Islam, which many countries do. I mean, look at Turkey. Despite the recent elections, you've got, and Phil is the obvious expert on Turkey, you've got, you know, a secular state. Now, regarding the separation of church and state in this country, I think that's one of the great blessings. I mean, fortunately, it's inherent in the Constitution, and I would not want to tamper with the basics of the Constitution because I would not like to turn this into a religious pogrom, one side against the other. We had a measure of that during the Crusades. Didn't work out very well. And I think that needs to be avoided. But the fundamental issue is that every religion has its zealots and its crazies, and I think that's what we're really dealing with here. But the problem is there are no longer any barriers. There are no barriers because of state borders or because of distance, because of the electronic age, globalization, and the ability to disrupt now is unbelievable. I go back to the two snipers. And if you really wanted to disrupt, I would get on the telephone right now and call up the director of the Port of New York, Port of San Francisco, and Galveston and saying, by the way, I've just put something nasty in one of the 6,000 containers that's coming into your harbor right now. Have a nice day. What do you think would happen? The same thing that happened on September 12th with the airports. So you now have a system that could be broke. And these people aren't stupid. And on top of that, they believe they're right. So my hope is that we don't turn this into a religious pogrom. But the tendency for people to make that connection is very, very, very real. And it's very difficult for us to inoculate because it's a natural reaction. Does that answer your question, or?
Yes, questions?
I don't necessarily think that the Israeli-Arab conflict, a solution to it would end the problem that we're facing with Islam in general. But I do think it is used as an excuse by many of the extremists for what their actions are. And I agree with you that we need to do something to, quote your words, impose a settlement of this conflict. How would you go about doing this? What? Get down to a little more specifics, yeah, in terms of how, what you would do.
Let me answer your question about the first, the implied question about whether, how much this thing contributes, the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian. On September 12th, Bin Laden learned four things he didn't know the day before. He didn't know that the building was going to fall down. The building's going to fall down. He didn't realize he was going to be able to disrupt the economy as much as he did. And so the challenge became, it's the economy, stupid. He didn't anticipate the might of the American military. And now the bad guys, unfortunately, have learned, don't silhouette yourself at night because they got infrared stuff and they can see you, so they've gotten smarter. And fourthly, he realized that the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian dispute was now something he could use to help enrage Muslims. So it was not present at the beginning with Bin Laden, but it is certainly present there. And it is certainly present among all of our Arab allies, Egypt, Saudis, so forth. And they've got a fair point. It's impossible right now to say who's right and who's wrong. I argue for tough love. I mean, the problem with the Palestinians is that they have become so desperate, and the Arabs are also responsible here. I don't know if any of you have ever been to the refugee camps in Palestine, in Gaza. They are horrible. They've been like that for 50 years, and the Arabs have kept them that way as a political dagger to use against the Israelis. It is absolutely outrageous. So I'm not taking sides here. But the Palestinians have become so desperate that suicide bombing, now with women, last January, there was a first suicide woman bomber. So that's what they're left with. The Israelis are left with only one instrument, the Israeli army. So now you have this clash that's going to continue. I think you've got to impose tough love. It's not a question of who's done what to whom. Both sides are wrong. Both sides are right. My view is that you would start someplace like Gaza, and you would actually impose, as we have done in Yugoslavia, military forces on the ground, and demilitarize it. There would be no Palestinian armed police. There would be no Israeli armed police. It would be this particular force that's taking charge. And they would simply demilitarize that particular area to show that this could work. And it would be difficult. People would be killed. There's no question about that on our side as well. And then from that, you would build confidence because you're dealing with hundreds of years of hostility and certainly, you know, nearly 60 years of the Arab-Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And, you know, the Israelis are absolutely right in that they're surrounded, and they can justifiably say their security is at risk. The Palestinians can rightly say, give us a break. We don't even have the rights of Israelis. You're not going to fix that overnight. You've got to develop trust and confidence, and the way you do it is to relieve the points for violence. And so you demilitarize a place like a small part of the Gaza Strip, send in basically military police forces, work that out, and then you go to the next stage. And at some place, if another Rabin ever comes along and another Sadat, then maybe we can work this out. The trouble is you've got two angry, old, ugly men who hate each other violently and wish to see each other dead in charge. There is no, I mean, you talk about a regime change. I'd love to see a regime change not only with Arafat, but Sharon, who's just as bad. The trouble is you might get Netanyahu, who's probably worse. So, but if we don't do that, there are going to be even greater breeding grounds for extremists who are going to associate us with the Israelis, because Sharon, you know, said this is the president who's treated us best of any presidents. Well, whether that's true or not, how does that play in the Arab world? You're leaning directly towards Israel. And at the end of the day, we're going to reap those fruits, which are not going to be very, very tasty ones, in my view.
Next question. Cliff.
I wonder if you can tell us what Tom Ridge has accomplished as the National Security Advisor to the President. Could somebody else with better presidential support have done more? And is he the man to head this elephantine new Department of Government?
I'm trying not to be too flippant. I am somewhat critical because I don't think that Ridge has moved nearly fast enough. But you got to realize that it was the White House that was at fault here, the president. I don't think the president has given him enough support. The political reality is you need somebody who's a lot tougher and I think a lot more experienced than Ridge, even though he served in Congress, was a governor, and has got a great record. You need somebody who's really has a sufficient past that he's not worried about his future. So he's prepared, you know that old story, if you embark on a campaign of revenge, dig two graves. Well, the head of that department ought to be digging two graves, and it ought to be his last job because he's going to have to alienate people to make this work. And I don't particularly think that Ridge is the right guy in that capacity. For the political system, given the way the political system operates, he's probably the right guy because he understands the limits. And the question is, who would you get who might be somewhat more powerful, somewhat more authoritarian, and can the system tolerate that?
Where would you look? Would you look at Wall Street? Would you look at that was in previous administration, that's always been the question. And you looked in the military, you looked in Wall Street, you looked in various other places. Where would you look?
Well, I can think of five or six general officers retired who I think would be absolutely spectacular. Would be absolutely spectacular. The White House would not let them get within a light year because, you know, these guys want to do things and break a lot of glass. If Powell were not so vitally important at Homeland Security, I would appoint him. I would also, if I couldn't appoint him, I think I'd look at somebody like John McCain. And I'd really lean on John and say, you need it for the good of your country, John, and boom, boom, boom. But I got to tell you, the chances of George Bush asking John McCain to do anything are about as good as you and I flying to the moon. So, but I mean, there are people. But what you have to do is give them the authority and the responsibility. And I think Tom Ridge is a very able, good man. But I think he's operating within the political confines, which means it's going to be very difficult to make it work. I'll give you an example. A very, very dear and dear friend of mine is Jim Schlesinger. Jim was remarkable because in every cabinet position he got fired. I mean, he was Secretary of Defense and Ford fired him. He was Carter's Secretary of Energy, the first guy to start the Energy Department, and Carter fired him. Now, Schlesinger is a man of great integrity, great substance, and he's tough. So, and I guess I would throw into my last nominee, if he weren't needed, over at Defense, I think about Rumsfeld. I think Don would be a hell of a good director or cabinet officer there. But I don't know that you could, pardon?
Giuliani?
He's too much of a politician. You know, this calls for tough stuff. You know, you got to make tough choices. You got to reprimand people. And there are very few politicians, I think, who are really willing or able to do that. So I don't think Rudy is the right guy. I mean, you don't need a figurehead who can make great speeches. You need a man of action. And I think Rumsfeld would certainly be one. But, boy, I tell you, I'd hate to be president with Don over at Homeland Defense with a charter because, you know, there'd be a buzzsaw. But that's the sort of people I think you need if this is going to work. We got to do this. This is a serious issue. We need serious people.
Victor Yonke.
Thank you. This organization and the objectives it's going to seek, how would you fit that in with the UN and NATO?
Which organization?
The one you're advocating.
I'm not getting your question. Which organization are you talking about?
Well, this new system, you were sort of an edge.
The National Security Act, you're talking about the new Marshall Plan? Are you talking about the new strategic stability talks?
Stability talks, yes.
Initially not. Where I would certainly want to use the UN and EU and other organizations would be in the Marshall Plan. In other words, I would like them to be part of the administration. I would prepare the resources, and I'd like somebody like the UN to be part of this. Regarding the sort of nuclear talks, the UN really at this stage is not needed. Neither, I think, is NATO. I think you just got to deal directly with the nuclear powers. I think that would be sufficient. And certainly in dealing with the Middle East, if we're going to do anything there, it's got to be done under a UN-EU international mandate. So that's how I would certainly incorporate them. I think the United Nations, despite the fact that it's painful going with 150 states, most of which do not like us, is still a powerful tool that we can use. And I'm just sorry the President did not go to the UN earlier to get this resolution dealing with Iraq, because 15-0, including a vote from Syria, is a powerful signal. Now, whether that signal is strong enough to move Saddam remains to be seen. But the UN offers a tremendous political tool if we are humble enough to use it. So I think it's essential that it becomes, along with other NGOs, non-government organizations. I mean, it's interesting that when I was in the military 100 years ago, you never knew what an NGO was. I mean, you went to graduate school like Fletcher, an NGO, you'd say, no good what? No good officer. That's what NGO means. And now, any officer you speak to, the first thing he or she refers to internationally is, what's the NGO we can come to help us? So there's been a sea change in thinking. That's how I would embark to use the UN more positively.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
The lady in the back.
In the back.
If you look in the Quran, in Shura 5, it would show this strong push towards getting the infidels. So it really has this violence against the infidels, considered U.S. is in there in the Quran. What I'm saying, what I want to know is, what is the U.S. Leadership doing right now to sort of engage Muslims, U.S. Muslims here, to become something like a watchdog against Islamic militantism here in the United States?
The question had to do with the Quran and the fact that there are passages in the Quran that advocate violence against infidels, as there are passages in the New and Old Testament that also suggest, you know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth is not exactly turn the other cheek. So I think that you're right. You know, you can read the Quran. Actually, I don't think there's any Westerner who's ever read the Quran but translations thereof. So you can read different bits and pieces. But I think generally most scholars of the Quran, and I am not one, would argue that Islam is not a religion that's based on particularly a violent ejection of the infidel. I think that's what most scholars would say. Now, your question really was, what about using American Muslims, either as watchdogs, which I don't think is a very good idea, because I don't like American citizens ratting on other American citizens. I think this sort of police force doesn't work. But more importantly, why are we not fighting the ideological battle against the bad version of Islam? What infuriates me, and I just think it's stupid, what's what infuriates me, Osama bin Laden has issued a series of fatwas, okay? A fatwa is a religious decree, in this case it's a hit, to kill various people. Now, why didn't we ask the question, on what authority can he issue a fatwa? And the answer is, he cannot, because he's not of sufficient religious training. Now, that comes from Sheikh Omar, the one-eyed guy in Afghanistan who's his wingman, saying that, you know, he does not have the religious legitimacy to do this. So his fatwa is illegitimate. Now, why we are not conducting a more vocal campaign is beyond me. Why we're being driven crazy by Al Jazeera television when we should be taking a more aggressive stand? You know, and the administration tries to go on time sometime, and it doesn't, is beyond my comprehension. I mean, I think that a voice of America, and we are beginning to project that, a much more powerful public diplomacy campaign is important. One of the difficulties, believe it or not, is getting the money for those programs through Congress. It's not that the money's not there, it just takes forever. One of the problems, going back to the Homeland Defense issue, how much have we spent on Homeland Defense that's been appropriated by Congress so far? The answer is close to zero, because we don't have the department yet. So we've got all this expectation of spending of money, but the Congress, by the way, hasn't even passed a budget. The only budget appropriation they passed is defense. It was out to do the 1st of October. So that the government itself is a hindrance to a lot of these things. But yes, there should be far more active public diplomacy taking on these issues and these lies and these fraudulent interpretations of Islam, in my judgment. We need to have far more people making that argument. And why we're not doing it on Al Jazeera, and why we're not doing it directly and challenging the legitimacy of bin Laden is really beyond my comprehension. But your point is very, very well taken.
Well, we've come to our adjournment time. We want to thank you very much for
my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Discussion.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much. Thank you.